Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 1:18 p.m. That is Pacific Summer Time. Today is May 14th, and today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. I thought I would kick off with gold because it was up $16 today, and it is now approaching the region of the simple moving average. But I think it's rather interesting that this chart from Bloomberg, it doesn't really allow you to put in an exponential moving average as a saved parameter. This seems to be a rather odd circumstance, but I thought it's interesting that we're seeing a little bit of resistance in the region of the simple moving average, and yet there's support around the $1,800 level from the exponential moving average. And in all my other charts, I use an exponential moving average. And the reason for that is because I believe that it is worth the time to give some additional credence to the most recent data. And we've certainly seen encouraging signs that gold has bottomed. And if gold has bottomed, well, then it's looking rather cheap relative to its peak value. And on top of that, considering we've had a very significant run-up in commodity prices already, and gold has really sat it out entirely, then we may see some rotation out of some of the more accelerated trends and into some of the less appreciated ones. And I think that is a potentially important rotation that could occur over the coming quarter. When we think about gold, it does best in a negative real interest rate environment. And that's a rather interesting way of thinking about markets, because there are lots of assets that should do well in a negative real interest rate environment. But one thing that we've seen over the last 9 months has been that gold has moved pretty much almost in lockstep with bonds. So we had a significant peak for gold back in August, and we've had a significant pullback since then. When we think about treasury prices, then we've seen that the price has bottomed, and it is steadying here from the 132 area. We had a meaningful pullback following the failed upside break last Friday, and it is steadying now, so it has still held the sequence of higher reaction lows. But there is a reticence among bond investors to buy aggressively, and this is quite odd. It's different to the kind of environment we've seen over the course of the last number of decades. When we think about the total performance, the total return on treasury futures, if one were to buy and roll all the way from 1980 all the way up to now, then it has done very little but rise. There was a significant loss of momentum between about 2016 and 2019, and since then we had a pop on the upside, and subsequently there's been a bit of a loss of momentum. If we just simply zoom in and look at the last decade, then we can see that we have had a bit of a rebound recently, and there is still some ways to go before it fully unwinds the oversold condition relative to the trend mean. But we haven't had the same kind of rebound that we had, for example, in 2017 or in 2019. Even when we had the dips below the trend mean in 2013, around the time of the taper tantrum, then we still had a really pronounced and quick rebound in the latter portion of the year. So far, this rebound has been pretty modest, and it might represent a reticence among investors to leap back into bonds because they really are worried about the intentions of the Federal Reserve in particular to devalue the currency. And rather than simply looking at isolated bond prices, then I think it's interesting that the Bloomberg Dollar Index doesn't get a lot of attention, but it's a better benchmark overall than the pure dollar index because it's less weighted by the euro. There's no question the euro is an important currency, but a 32% weighting is probably sufficient in any benchmark. And then it also includes things like the renminbi and the Indian rupee and the Mexican peso. So it, I think, is a better representation of what we might anticipate from the outlook for the dollar. And what we are presented with here is a type 3 top formation. Now, obviously, there are going to be two arguments because a type 3 top formation is defined by ranging time and size. It's also a war between supply and demand. So there are going to be very forceful arguments that are polar opposite in nature. So there's going to be some people that say, well, golly, this is just a range. It's a big consolidation before we see a significant run on the upside, because you might think that the dollar is weak, but everywhere else is worse. And the demographics in places like Europe and Japan are way worse than they are in the USA, and the technology advantage that the USA has is so profound that growth there will outpace everywhere else. So you couldn't possibly have a bear market for the dollar. Then, of course, there's going to be the opposite argument, which is that the US government is printing money like it is going out of fashion. And as they continue to ramp up deficits on every front, then we're simply looking at a supply surfeit argument, that there is much more supply than demand, and that they are determined to devalue their currency and to inflate, or I guess perhaps the most important way of thinking about it is not to say inflate their way out of trouble, but rather to print as many dollars as is required to pay off the extraordinary quantity of money that is being printed. So those are two arguments, and they are difficult to reconcile. But the most important thing is that as a range persists, and as we see evidence of failed upside breaks, then we can see that every time it has failed to get back above the 1250 area, it has come straight back down to a new low. And it did that in 2017, and it did it again in 2020. And now we're right on the region of the lows, and it has encountered resistance again in the region of the trend mean. There were certainly contrarians that were looking at the oversold condition that we had in early January and thinking this must be a bottom for the dollar, it's a perfect time to buy. And it was for about 2 months. But now we're right back on the lows again. And there is no real willingness among politicians to rein in debts. And on top of that, they don't seem to have any real appetite for how they're going to withdraw some of the extraordinary assistance that's been provided to the economy. So we have these outsized unemployment benefits, which are clearly distortionary, because if you provide 50% of the population with higher unemployment benefits than they get from working, well, what on earth is the rationale for going back to work? So there are more than 6 million jobs that have yet to be filled, and companies are coming under pressure to raise wages. This has been a growing trend for really quite some time. We can definitely think about the fact that companies like McDonald's are investing heavily in automation. And when one goes into a McDonald's these days, well, you're presented with a load of LCD screens. So the counter staff has been reduced significantly. And then they are also experimenting with robotics in the kitchen. And in the meantime, they are raising prices. I remember that I used to buy my children when they got 100% on their math tests, our deal was that they would get an ice cream cone on the way home from school. And when we first started doing that, when they were very small, we used to go to McDonald's and get an ice cream, and it was $1 an ice cream. And today it's 170. So in the space of 5 years, the price has gone from $1 to 170, and that is a lot. That's a significant inflation. Now, so they try to keep their headline items without a big cost increase, but then they put costs on everything else. And that's why the share price has been able to recover, and it is still at new highs, and it is now finding support in the region of the previous peak. So this looks like nothing more than a consolidation. We're definitely also seeing that companies like Costco, which have a long history of giving their employees an annual pay increase for every year of service, well, they're also now raising their minimum wage, and or at least what might be described as the starting wage. Well, they're obviously going to also raise prices, and the way some of these companies do it is through shrinkflation. So, this devaluation of the currency and the pressure that is coming to bear on companies to raise wages. We can think about Amazon and the number of employees that they have. It's currently, as of March, at 1.271 million, and they are increasing their minimum wage. Walmart employs 2.2 million people, and they're also raising their minimum wages. So this puts upward pressure on every other wage category, because if the minimum wage is somewhere between $13 and $15, and in other places upwards of $17, then the people that were once earning $20 are going to want $25, and it's that push factor. So there are two important characteristics of this. The first is simple enough, that if people are demanding higher wages, well, then eventually companies have to respond because they won't have employees otherwise. And the government is supporting that trend because of the very generous unemployment benefits. But then they are also supporting consumers by the ban on evictions, and then the various stimulus checks on top of that. And these are very significant factors. So what they are in fact doing is greatly increasing the level of at which poverty would be considered, or where people would be in the poverty line. And that's directly inflationary, because there's no willingness among the political class to tackle it, and they are deliberately courting inflation, and that is perhaps why we haven't had a more aggressive rebound in treasury prices. There's still the scope that we might yet get an additional rebound in treasury prices, but there's certainly not an aggressive move to do it, because people are getting a little bit leery about the inflationary problems. We can then think about the inflationary pressures that are starting to come through. So, the year-over-year earnings demands has been really quite loopy, because we had this extraordinary move upwards in early 2020, because there were fewer people working, and those that were getting pay rises. So we had a big jump in the earnings of people. Then it collapsed again in the first quarter of this year because of the year-over-year comparison. So it's currently sitting at 0.33, but that is relative to April of last year. And of course, that doesn't make sense, because obviously we've had this big pop on the upside a year ago, which means that wages are still growing at 8%. It's just that they're not growing at 9%. So if we then think about this on a month-over-month basis, well, it does a better job of ironing out some of those inconsistencies. And what we can in fact see is that wages are now starting to pop back up again. So you can see definitely that in the period from 2006 through to 2020, that we did have a little bit of volatility from month to month, and back then it looked like a lot. But Everything now has been changed as a result of the pandemic, and it's currently sitting around 0.7% on a month-over-month basis. So there is definitely upward pressure on wages. And that is so far positive because wage demand growth, before we have the clear change in inflationary pressures, which will be incontrovertible in the data, well, then that does help to improve living standards. And it is helping to create demand for lots of different assets. And that's also being fostered by these supply constraints, because there's been a lot of that. But we're definitely also starting to see some of these short-term factors coming under pressure. So lumber has been limit down 5 days in a row, and I think it is now logical to conclude that this trend is over. And this extraordinary spike higher in lumber prices, which has had the meme community on fire over the course of the last 4 or 5 months, is in fact over. And it could quite easily come all the way back down and test the region of the moving average. In other words, we could see prices for lumber halve. But it's worth considering that this was an awfully big breakout. And we've had long histories of very long base formations, which just simply never come back down into the bases. So it could quite easily come back to $800. It could even come back to $600. But it's unlikely that we're going to see lumber prices pull all the way back below $400 again. That, generally speaking, when we get big breakouts in commodities, then they have generally held those breakouts. It's exactly the same thing that happened in the period up from about 1990 to 1994. We had an initial pop on the upside, a bit of ranging, and a massive surge. We had initial pop, a bit of ranging, and then another massive surge. Subsequently, the prices never came back down into the pre-1994 region. So, and in fact, that's not quite true. It did pull back into that area around 2008 and it wasn't sustained. So, it's quite likely that we're going to see lumber prices coming back into the $400 to $500 area, but extremely unlikely that they'll go below that level. In other words, we've had a step change in the marginal cost of production. And it's not difficult to understand what that might be. There are two factors. The first, of course, is the mountain pine beetle, and the migration patterns have been significantly adjusted by warmer winters, particularly across Canada. And then, so then the majority of lumber is coming out of the US Southwest these days. Excuse me, Southeast. And then, of course, you have rising wages. So there's, and generally speaking, it is mining and lumber tend to be among the best paid of all manufacturing sectors. So, or any sector of the economy, because they are difficult and dangerous. But there is certainly going to be a pop on the upside for lumber workers because there just aren't enough of them, and most particularly there aren't enough of them in the US Southeast relative to the Pacific Northwest. So we do get these step changes. Of course, we've also had this chronic shortage of semiconductors, and the Philadelphia Semiconductor Index has lost momentum, but it was well off the lows in here today. One thing that's, I think, particularly relevant is that Taiwan has been especially volatile. And the Taiwanese stock market pulled back in a very violent manner this week, and it did close well off the lows. Taiwan Semiconductor has certainly also been pulling back. The challenge here is that Taiwan Semiconductor has got manufacturing constraints. So it doesn't matter how much demand for chips there is, they are not in a position to produce more. Then on top of that, you had power cuts in Taiwan yesterday that were quite random. And then there is the issue with the drought. So there is water shortages as well. those factors are weighing on the stock right now because they are not in a position to benefit from this continued demand. They didn't have a problem with finding customers in the past, and they're going to spend a very significant amount of money on building new facilities. So that was something that was quite clear from Samsung's earnings announcement this week. They had planned to spend a And these are, I think, approximate numbers because I can't remember exact numbers, but it was something in the region of about 110 billion. And this week they announced another 120 billion that they were going to invest in new manufacturing capacity over the course of the next decade. And they seek now to become the number one producer of logic chips. So, in many respects, Taiwan Semiconductor is the lead performer of the con excuse me. Taiwan Semiconductor is the lead manufacturer of CPUs. Samsung produces memory, and now they also want to be the leader in logic chips. So, over the course of the next 9 years, Samsung is anticipating spending in excess of $250 billion on building out that kind of manufacturing capacity. So that's an enormous sum of money, and they're sufficiently well capitalized that they can achieve it because they have a long history of being able to meet their goals. But that's a lot of money that's going to have to get spent. And it's going to sap growth. And we saw similar kinds of ranges forming when Tesla announced that they were going to build their first gigafactory. It required an enormous amount of money, and once it was built, the share took off again. It's not beyond the bounds of possibility that the massive amounts of money that will have to be spent on capital investment for these companies may weigh on their ability to continue to grow and to grow dividends or to reward shareholders. So these are certainly factors that are important because the supply chain is going to increase and improve over the coming years, but the shortage of chips is still a factor, and it's another example of bottlenecks. Then, of course, in here this week, we had And we're simply not going to see the effect in gasoline prices. But this week, there was a massive pipeline shutdown in the USA as a result of ransomware attacks. And they were only able to successfully end it because they paid the 5 million bounty and or the ransom. And unfortunately, the de-encryption software they were provided was incredibly slow and not faster than their reboot from saved files. So they basically spent $5 million on nothing, only to successfully embolden criminals that these are really fat targets. So it's absolutely inevitable that criminal organizations are going to continue to target hospitals, public institutions, the police, fire stations, and then also significant pieces of infrastructure like power stations and pipeline services, refineries. So these are obviously going to represent threats in terms of businesses, but also threats in terms of the just simple public's confidence in the ability of national institutions to supply services. Obviously, there was the big problem as well earlier this year with the Texas blackouts, and that obviously shook confidence in the ability of the regulators to balance the grid as well. Then, of course, this week, we also saw that there was a bridge over the Mississippi, which had a massive crack in it. So that stopped more than 700 barges from moving soybeans down for export, and the price is now pausing in the region of the upper side of what's effectively a more than decade-long range. Now we have a very clear short-term overbought condition, and we now have some evidence of a pause starting to come through. And the price was not quite able to hold on to a rally in here today. I think it's quite likely we're going to have at least some pause in consolidation. But these are short-term inflationary issues. So it would be very easy to just panic and say, oh, these are to think about the inflation as being inevitable. But the reality is that we have both short-term exogenous shocks. We have short-term challenges in terms of the kinds of risks that are appearing because of vulnerable infrastructure. Then we have wage demand growth, and there is nothing short-term about that, because once people get a pay rise, they will do anything to avoid losing it. So once wages go up, it is very hard to put that genie back in the bottle. And then, of course, people will use the shorter-term exogenous shock factors to supplement their argument that inflation is a problem and needs to be dealt with permanent measures. And this seems to be exactly what we're seeing, and seeing it all over the world. So it's very likely that what we are now seeing is a new inflationary signal, which brings us all the way back down to gold. Because gold prices are now steadying, and we are at a point where there's a decision to be made. Because the most important thing about this trend on the downside is we've had these series of lower rally highs. And this area around the 1850 area is probably the most recent of those. If gold can then sustain a move above the simple moving average and demonstrate support in the region of it, well, then it's quite clear that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. When we think about silver, silver prices have simply been going sideways, and they have found support in the region of the trend mean on successive occasions. And this whole range just looks like a first step above the base. And generally, when you get a first step above the base, you get an argument forming. You get an argument about whether it's a secular bull market or a cyclical bull market, whether the price hasn't gone up enough already, and how could it possibly go up more from here. But all you need to do is to see that the price can sustain the breakout, and that just tells us that there are people willing to pay more for silver today than they were at any point over the last 8 years. And there's a reason for that, because they're worried about inflation. They're worried about the clear determination to print the currency into oblivion, and the very clear reality that we are in a competitive devaluation environment. It's then, if we think about gold and silver, well, then the gold miners index is, or the ETF, has rebounded from the 30 area. It also has first step above the base characteristics, but more importantly than that, it has now clearly broken its sequence of lower rally highs. So it is potentially now offering a lead indicator for what we might anticipate from the gold price. And it would suggest that this is probably one of those opportunities to initiate prices before we see a break on the upside. The longest running adage of this service has been don't pay up for commodities. The reality is that soybeans and lumber have done very well in a very short period of time, but gold and silver have been very much on the sidelines. We can then think about some of the notable performers right now. So Hecla Mining is a major silver producer, and it is now just right in the region of the upper side of this 9-year range. So there is clear potential that it is going to break on the upside and complete its own little base formation. Newmont has been ranging for an even longer amount of time, and it's ranges within ranges, depending on how much back history one is willing to look at. We had this almost cataclysmic decline between 2011 and 2015, then another big range and another big breakout, and now we have another big range. And this range, going from 55 all the way up to 70, it's likely that we're going to see the share break on the upside and run again. That's one of the things that people find most attractive about gold and gold investments. It's that when they go, they can really go. And in between those big trends, they tend to go sideways for what feels like forever. And then we have Gold Fields, and it has just popped back above its trend mean. And of course, that is the South African listing. So when we look then at the US listing, and I'm finding the ticker, sorry about that. When we think about what the potential is here, there's obviously scope that the gold shares are going to perform in a more robust manner in this cycle than they did in the last. The big characteristic for gold miners going all the way back into the last bull market was that they had to spend a massive amount of money. And when we think about the big bear market that preceded the bull market in 2001 and 2 and 3 up to 2011, miners had been through an incredibly long period where they just were not in a position to build. So that put them under a great deal of pressure to go out and explore and replace reserves, and they spent way more money than they could ever have thought about. But it led to massive underperformance of their shares. Now, what we're instead starting to see now is mergers and acquisitions. So they're not going out and buying land, they're going out and buying companies. They're letting sunk capital into, or they're basically buying sunk capital at a discount, so that they now have the clear knowledge that these companies are able to provide gold. Now, when we think about what all this means in terms of the gold sector, well, we have a set of conditions right now where gold prices are around $1,800. The vast majority of all-in sustaining costs are in the region of 1,000, and a lot of them are below 1,000. So we have these gold miners that are making anywhere from 75 to 100% margins on their production. And AISC is an extremely conservative way of assessing profitability. So it really means that they can guaranteed make that kind of money on a sustained basis. Well, what it really then suggests is that the gold miners are now in a position to offer leverage to the gold price. So the nice thing about the NYSE Arca's gold miners ETF is that it has lots of back history. So we get a lot more history than we did with the GDX. And we can definitely see that there was a time when gold shares did do well in the last bull market, and it was right at the beginning. And as they made money, they spent every penny of it. And then they just could not hold their outperformance, and they underperformed then in a spectacular manner when gold prices were under pressure. And now we're at a different scenario. We're at a point where they don't want to spend their money, and they would much rather reward investors. And the dividends from gold miners are appreciating, and they're not going out and spending on green and new builds or greenfield sites. So that suggests that as gold prices start to move again, then gold shares will offer the kind of leverage to the gold price, and for the and that was, of course, the reason why people bought them in the first place. Then, of course, there is the big question about Bitcoin and what happens next. Because at one point today it was up $2,000, and as we head into an hour after the close, it has given up the entire advance. I've been really quite clear since the beginning of March that this was increasingly risky, and that we have clear evidence of a loss of consistency. And when we start to see a clear loss of consistency after an accelerated and really very rewarding and impressive trend, it is a sign that supply and demand are coming back into balance and may even be rolling over. So there is the potential here that Bitcoin is going to break downwards additionally and come back down and test the 40,000 level before we see the next bounce. But the challenge here is that it will start to siphon money out of alternatives. And the Ethereum price got all the way back up to the $4,100 area in here today. In fact, it triggered my stop on my short position, so I took a small profit out of my short, and I am weighing now whether I won't just simply reinitiate the short at current levels. But the reality right now is that we've had an incredible acceleration, and we're seeing right across all markets that where we've had accelerations, they're starting to be unwound. And this is as true of the cryptocurrencies as it is of the commodity sector generally. Well, the challenge, of course, is that now we have a lot more institutional investors, and there is an incredibly large amount of hot money floating around. And there were news stories this week about how traders that used to be very active as market makers in the pits in Chicago and in London, for that matter, are now finding that all of their old trading strategies work again in the crypto markets. Of course, they used to get up to a lot of nefarious shenanigans in the 1980s and 1990s on trading floors, and those were regulated markets. Cryptocurrencies aren't regulated in the slightest, so you get to use all of the old trading strategies that worked, and then you get to use all of the nefarious trading strategies that worked in the 1920s. So there is an incredible amount of leverage in these markets, and there is a lot of money floating around, and there is a lot of money floating between venues, and it's all searching for outsized profits. But the more people that are looking for outsized profits, the more difficult it is to find them. And then we have this succession of new coins and tokens being minted on practically a daily basis. And every one of them is trying to angle to attract this massive source of flow. They can't all possibly succeed, and the last time we saw this was in 2017, and more than half of those tokens went bust. So there's certainly a gold rush on, and of course that is one of the most exciting factors about it. But we also know that when we go back and look at the Bitcoin price, where it has generally tended to find support after periods of extraordinary volatility, is in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. So if we're thinking about downside targets, Well, the potential is that Bitcoin could come back down to $12,500. And that's an awfully long way from where we are today. Well, considering that Bitcoin had a market cap of a trillion until quite recently, well, then we can think about the outlook for Tesla. They've been buying Bitcoin, and now they're no longer accepting it as a payment for their cars. The share is steadying now in the region of the trend mean, and it may well do better from here. But if Bitcoin breaks downwards, well, it's going to take a lump out of their balance sheet, and obviously the cash that they made from their Bitcoin investments has been added to the share price, and it's quite likely that any money that comes out of Bitcoin will get subtracted from their balance sheet and from their share price as well. There were a couple of interesting things that I think are worth really focusing on, because commodities bottomed in the early 2000s, and growth really started to come down in the early 2000s. So we had this massive rotation out of growth and into more real assets. And that run up from 2001 through to 2008 and then on again to 2011 was a phenomenal bull market in commodities overall. We can think about how the copper price has been resurgent over the course of the last year. So we've had a profound advance, and this advance is now in excess of the initial advance that we had in the period up from the lows in 2009. So I think this is I think an important characteristic that we have this very I think impressive advance up off the lows, and now copper is at a new all-time high. So we're getting some consolidation, but it's not, so far at least, a big consolidation. But it's very likely we will get some consolidation because every other accelerated trend out there has rolled over. And as they roll over, then the hot money starts to come out and it gets poured into more secure assets. So that's why the recent strength in gold is notable. Because if we have the dollar weakening and investors looking for a safe haven against inflation, and then additionally we have accelerated trends that are starting to look overbought, well, then obviously there has got to be somewhere to put the money. This week we saw that both bonds and equities fell on the same day, on Thursday, and that contributed to some volatility on Wall Street, and the S&P had a one-day pullback. It has subsequently steadied, and the VIX index is starting to come back down again. So these types of environment where we get both bonds and equities falling together, the reason that that occurs and why volatility spikes as a result of it is simple enough that algorithmic traders have to reduce the size of their positions when volatility spikes. And the more, and of course, because they sell, volatility spikes more. And this has been a factor that has popped up from time to time over the last year. And the most important thing, though, is that every time we've had a pop in the upside from volatility, it has peaked at a lower level. So we're still in a very liquid environment. We still have very accommodative financial conditions. And it suggests that we're going to have an additional run on the upside for stocks. We're still in a very benign environment. And I'm more looking at a rotation than a peak. Personally think that some of the stay-at-home companies are, well, let's put some names on them. I think Zoom Media is not going to survive beyond the next few years, but it is oversold in the short term, and it has popped on the upside in here today. Peloton is facing some significant class action lawsuits because they've killed children with their machines, and yet the share has also rebounded in here today. So we're definitely seeing now that some of the oversold conditions are also starting to be unwound. So there is a massive rotation going on where the big accelerated trends on the upside are giving up some of their gains, and some of the most oversold conditions are starting to rebound again. And I think that this is representative of the wider economy. But then, of course, we have this clear change of trend in value versus growth. And this is also reminiscent of what we saw coming off the lows in 2001. And it's again looking at real assets and looking at not simply the real asset, but real money and real cash flows, and paying some respect to the companies that have been able to survive throughout decades and have been able to increase their prices along the way and dominate their respective niches and have truly global franchises so that they're not specifically tied down to a single country. And the dividend aristocrats are well positioned there as well. And we have also got short-term overbought conditions here, but these kinds of companies are becoming progressively more attractive because of their long histories of paying and increasing dividends. When it comes to inflation hedges, then these types of companies really are the gold standard, and followed very quickly by gold. But then we have the continued performance of Europe, because Europe falls into the value category, and it is very influenced by global growth. So the Euro Stoxx index is like right in the region of the upper side of this 21-year range and likely to break on the upside. And there is clear potential that it is going to run on and have a new bull market for Europe. When we think about the DAX index, it rebounded in emphatic fashion earlier this week and followed through on the upside in here today. It's clearly outperforming and has now completed its own 4-year range. The FTSE 250 in the UK has also rebounded pretty emphatically from the 22,000 level, so that is now completing its own range. We're also seeing that because the dollar is leading the world in attempting to devalue its currency, then the pound is now stabilizing above the 140 area. The Europeans seem content so far to simply talk the currency down rather than doing anything about it. So the euro is firming from the 120 area. The one country where the USA has some competition for the weakest currency is Japan, and the Nikkei has pulled back this week, but the yen looks like it could break downwards. So the time when the Nikkei did particularly well in 2012 and 13 was when Abenomics devalued the currency, and the Nikkei found support in the region of the trend mean in here this week. If Japan devalues the currency, then the stock market should show nominal price appreciation on a currency hedged basis. Well, I should say in a currency unhedged basis. When we think about the longer term arguments, well, gold looks like it's cheap. Copper looks like it's going to break on the upside. The European indices look like they are going to do better from here, and that these look like significant recovery candidates simply on a value basis. The Japanese market has completed a base formation and is looking quite likely that it is going to surmount the peak from back in 1989 before this bull market is over and perhaps exceeded by a considerable margin. Then we have the fact that the technology sector in the USA is very interest rate sensitive and it's not trading at attractive valuations. And when the dollar trades lower, well, then other parts of the world become more attractive and the commodity producers turn into these or they tend to benefit from trade surpluses. And the emerging markets tend to benefit from their higher growth rates and trading between each other. And then we can think about China. It's obviously an area where we have a lot of geopolitical risk, but the A-share index is bouncing from the region of the trend mean. And I'm not necessarily saying that China is the most attractive place to invest, but it does trade on a lower valuation. The H-share index in Hong Kong has been ranging for a year and it has really struggled to demonstrate support. But as long as China's not breaking downwards, and as long as their economy is still a source of major demand for the rest of Asia, then we're likely to have a very benign environment in emerging markets. The challenge, of course, with investing in emerging markets is that the MSCI Emerging Markets ETF is heavily weighted by technology companies. So it has been trading more like a tech index than a value index over the course of the last few years. If we then think about the Indian market, I think just the simple rationale that the rest of the world simply cannot afford for India to fail. So it's likely that India will continue to be a regional outperformer, although the market is susceptible to occasional spikes on the downside, and they have almost universally been buying opportunities. It's going to be a volatile market, but the reality is that they have some of the best demographics in the world, and that demographic dividend is a significant tailwind as inflationary pressures rise and wages rise. And that's not just a US phenomenon, that's a global phenomenon for anywhere that has an aging population. And certainly, China is falling into that category these days. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.